This is a Glass Box Media Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and navigating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Paley Phillips, and with me in his den of rainbows is Jim Daly.
Den of rainbows. I'll take that. Our guest this week didn't actually mention the rainbows, which is the first time that's happened in a while, so I don't know if he just thought I just have loads of rainbows in my room, but I'm happy to be known as someone that has rainbows in their room.
So I keep coming up with...
absolutely fine.
I don't know about you, but I keep hearing great names for bands. Like, so Den of Rainbows would be a good, like, kind of new wave band, I reckon.
Rainbows in My Room. Maybe that's the first album.
Den of Rainbows, Rainbows in My Room.
Lovely.
Every song title's got a rainbow in it.
It's quite 60s. I think there'd be a sort of 60s.
Yeah, new wave, a bit of a throwback. Kind of. Yeah. Yeah, maybe like, yeah, kind of just called The Rainbows.
Just rainbows. How are you?
I'm okay, man. How are you? The sun's out. We've definitely into summer now. It's actually been really warm. I mean, this is a very British thing to say. I mean, obviously we have American listeners. I don't know if Americans talk about the weather as much as we do in the UK. It's just because it's so indifferent and changeable, it seems to be like the go-to kind of conversation starter.
Yeah, we do talk about it a lot. I don't know why that is. Are we just really bad at chat? Are we just quite boring people, like the Brits?
Yeah, well, I think we can be quite boring.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is. But never mind. Hey, I'm happy to talk about it. It's beautiful and sunny here.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll get out this afternoon. But who knows if I will. I need to tell you about something that I've done on my phone and laptop this week. I don't know if this is good chat or not, but it's quite geeky, but I'm quite enjoying it. I got a new phone.
Nice.
So I'm moving. I got a Samsung S23.
Ooh, so I'm like moving. Look at this.
I've never got like a current phone.
I'm
very proud of it.
Yeah, yeah. You've upped the contract there.
My monthly costs have gone up massively. But yeah, I feel like I use it for work.
How big is it as well? Because like the phones seem to be getting bigger and bigger. I mean, it's like
smaller.
Oh, smaller. Oh, okay, interesting.
I had my previous one was bigger and it was too big for me. This is more
We're holding our phones up, but I mean, it's meaningless to the listeners.
But what I did, I was answering emails and stuff. And like, I suddenly thought, what? I hate typing messages. What? Surely I can like dictate stuff and it would pick it up. And
oh, come on.
Turns out, yeah, you can. You can. I know. You can.
It's called voice to text.
So I got a certain Google style. Had a different name for it. Anyway, it's changed my life. It's amazing. Because like often I'm like doing, I'm holding a baby, like I'm doing other stuff. And I can just pick it up and just like, dictate my WhatsApp messages, my emails. Oh my God, it's changed my entire life. Firstly, it makes me feel quite powerful, like I'm sort of like high-powered business person. But it's just saved so much time. So yeah, that's what happened to me. That's been my big thing this week.
So you just like wandering down the road going, sell, buy.
buy. Cancel by 9 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah. Tell Linda I'm going to the golf course.
I do want to learn golf. That's a conversation for a different day. But anyway, that's what I've done this week. What have you done this week? Anything exciting?
Just going back on that. Yeah, I mean, I've definitely switched to doing more voice notes on WhatsApp and stuff. I mean, maybe it's just complete laziness. But yeah, don't text as much. More voice notes. Although not everyone's up for the voice notes. There's been a few times where I've sent a voice note to someone and I've just got a text back and I'm thinking, okay, they're not down with the voice notes. Some people just aren't, but then there are others who just, you know, just voice note all the time. And I think it does save time. Also, I don't know about you, but you get more nuance, don't you? Like, because sometimes with an email or like written text, you can't always convey your feelings or your emotions, and people take things the wrong way and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think it is the way forward, maybe just to verbalize things in an audio thing, just like this podcast.
The only thing I find when I'm doing voice notes is I end up talking for much longer.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do that. Like, you know, people get like 10, 15-minute voice notes. like a basically like a TED because talk. But
that's what happens in conversation. Whereas I think when you're writing it down, you're a bit more succinct. But it is nice that it's nice. It's funny we're talking about voices.
That's well, it always happens, doesn't it? It always happens.
Yeah, because this week's guest is a master of voices.
Oh, probably one of the greatest impressionists, impersonators that we've seen in the UK. It's the amazing John Coleshaw.
It is. And may I say, what a nice guy.
Yeah, wonderful company. Was very like open to doing a lot of the voices. And obviously we talked about how that is actually, you know, quite a part of his makeup as a person, the way he, you know, conducts himself in conversation and stuff. He just dives into, you know, voices and uses voices as a way of expressing himself. And just such a delight and so many great voices. I mean, like when he started doing Chris Eubank, I mean, it felt like Chris was in the room. And I did say at one point, maybe we should have just got, seeing as we don't do video content for this podcast, we could have just got John to come in every week and do various different high profile guests. And it probably would have been like no one would have known any different.
So this episode hasn't just got one guest, it's got about a dozen.
Yeah.
This is the first episode where we got, I mean, he's just such a lovely, joyous person, and it was a very joyous episode. He's really warm, a lovely sort of silly, playful silliness to his character and to his voice, and just fantastic company. So I really appreciate his time, and you got a bit of everything. You got lots of silliness in this episode, but also he talks about, you know, you asked a really lovely question towards the end about where's the real John, you know, where's the real John's voice, and he really opens up about that. So yeah, it was a great episode, this one. But I knew it would be. It really delivered.
Yeah, absolutely did. Absolutely did. So yeah, thank you, John, for coming on. I guess we should probably just crack on, really, because people don't want to hear us waffling on about your new phone and texting.
It is good, though. It is good. Anyway, no, fine. I'll go off and play with my new phone. But in the meantime, here is the one and only John Coleshaw on the Blank Podcast.
How are you?
Very well, very well. Lovely to speak to you. And thank you for all of those lovely, kind things that you say on the Twitter every Friday.
Oh,
I feel very humbled.
Oh, no.
And it don't go unnoticed, and it's very appreciated.
Oh, well, I'm glad. No, it's lovely to connect with people like yourself, you know, and the better sides of Twitter. Sometimes, you know, obviously it gets a bad name, but there are some positives.
Yes, exactly. Usually you imagine that if Twitter was to have a facial expression, you know, it'd be something like this. It would sound like that, you know. People don't like, you'd be just talking that way.
I think you'll find. I think you'll find it's very much that vibe.
Look, bruh, you know, all I was saying was bruh. You know, helps.
Exactly.
That'd be a good sketch, wouldn't it?
I was about to say that's a sketch. That's a sketch.
There you go.
It's very relatable.
You can have that fun from us. Yeah, there we go.
We did. We evolved that quite nicely, I thought.
Yeah. Yes. I can feel something special going. Some special, something special is happening here.
Okay, I'm pressing. Got it.
I know. I saw that because I very rarely go on other people's podcasts. I have to say, I'm not often asked. And then I had one last week, and it came up with the got it thing, and I was like, oh, that's a bit. That seems like a bit uncouth. Like, I got it.
Got it, mate.
Yeah.
Language has become very informal, which is fine in, you know, normal day-to-day conversations. But if one is broadcasting, I think one should make the effort. You know, these news readers who don't pronounce the letter G, it ain't good.
Or it.
Got to make an effort when one is broadcasting or speaking in a formal manner, you see.
My daughter has started dropping her H's, dropping her T's and her H's, and my wife is a trained actor who likes to try and talk in RP as much as possible. And so it's very clear where it's come from. It's come from this guy. So I'm already in trouble. My daughter's only three and I've ruined her life already.
I can hear your H's and your T's perfectly fine.
Thank you. I'm trying really hard this time.
Well, he's broadcasting. This is why.
Exactly.
Yeah. But John, so obviously, like we often in this podcast, we start at the beginning, and you're from You're from Lancashire.
Yes.
Is that the right way to say it? Lancashire.
Yeah, Lancashire, yes. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's the way.
Mm. Yeah. What was growing up in Lancashire like? Often we talk about school to start with, because it always seems to be like something that we can all reminisce about. But, I mean, were you typical impersonating that, you know, lots of people say when they're impersonation that they took off the teachers and things like that and your school friends. Did you do that kind of stuff?
Oh, I did that all the time. Mm. All the time. And growing up in Lancashire in the 1970s was a very lovely scene in which to have your childhood, I think. I feel very lucky in that respect. I'm quite sure that everything had a bronze tint in the 70s. Everything was sort of a tawny golden shade. It was the golden hour permanently. But it was very, very lovely. And I did used to take off the teachers a great deal. Elvis I used to impersonate. My brother Jim's a big Elvis fan and had stacks of his albums. And so Elvis often played at home. And I used to be able to do an Elvis impression that I was very proud of when I was about 8, 9, and 10. But I had a brace fitted. And, you know, for a while, you know, that makes you talk in this manner, teeth all fixed. The ability to do it lapsed. So I must relearn it. It might be a nice one to relearn, see if I can recapture it somehow.
So were you singing as Elvis, or were you doing like the sort of, you know, like the one form?
Yeah, I could do the voice. Thing.
Okay. Because singing impersonations is quite a different thing.
Hmm. Yeah, yes. I remember once at St. Anne's Junior School, and at the end of term, there was a competition in the school hall where those who wish to... Actually, they wouldn't have spoken like that. You know, those of you who would like to prepare a performance or a song of some kind, you're more than welcome. And, you know, some of the kids would sing All Things Bright and Beautiful. And, you know, the night, there's lovely hymns. And I thought it might be rather nice to sing That's All Right, Mama by Elvis, which I did. And my fellow pupils... You know, the kids loved all that, and I became a sort of almost like a folk hero amongst my friends and the rest of the class. But the teachers rather frowned upon this, I think, and thought it a bit raucous, and I was marked last.
Really?
As I was sort of chastised for it, which is ridiculous, isn't it? It is ridiculous. But I always liked to be a little bit benevolently rebellious, you know.
And that was one way. When you were taking off the teachers, were you doing that in the playground or were you doing it in class? And what was the teachers' reactions like? Were they, I'm guessing, probably not positive?
There was one reaction later, once I got to high school. This would have been in about 1979 or 1980. And I was 11 or 12 at the time. And we had the history class, and the history teacher had a wonderfully distinctive tone of voice, you know, and it was irresistible to copy. And once after a wet break, you know, remember wet break when you couldn't go out?
Yeah.
And you were just at a classroom with condensation and grumpy prefects. And double history after this. Well, I took upon myself, I've got to try and raise morale here. And I will do this by impersonating the history teacher. So there I was at the board talking about Hannibal and Xerxes' fleet and Boadicea. It's pronounced Boadicea, not Boudica, as some people like to say. And the class is laughing along, and this is G-ing me along. And I'm so in my stride that I failed to notice at one point that the class have stopped laughing. And then some sort of tractor beam of instinct makes me look to the door of room 11, the history room. that room is etched in my mind. And there was dear Mr. Platford standing in the doorway. And, right, you remain after class detention. And I thought I was in dreadful trouble. Caught red-handed, ridiculing the teacher. But once all the class had gone, his first words was, "Do I really speak that way?" My wife does say I can sound strangely, and I've always dismissed it. Anyway, I'll have to believe it now, won't I? And go home and don't tell anyone I sent you. And years later, I went to make a presentation at this school and he was there.
Oh, wow.
And it was lovely to say hello. And he said, well, at least I taught you something, eh? That was very sweet.
That's awesome. Yeah. So do you think, like, even in those early days of doing that, did you feel like maybe this was something that you might end up doing, like performing? I mean, were you into drama and stuff like that as well? Like,
yeah. Yes, I always enjoyed those lessons where you could read something out, where you had to sort of perform something, make some kind of presentation. I found that I had a bit of an affinity for that. At this stage, I wasn't dreaming about anything that could become a career. It was just simply a bit of fun. It was a bit of a laugh. I used to love impersonating local characters around the dinner table, and it made my mum and dad and sister and brother and made people smile. You know, Charlie James, the decorator, you know, he had this great Lancashire accent like that, you know, talking quite brisk. He sounded a bit like, you know, if you took, you know, like Fred Dibner, oh, that's great, like, sort of born in Victorian times, speeded him up a little bit, as if he was playing on 1.5 speed. It's like with audiobooks. That was what Charlie James sounded like. And I used to love just local characters. And when I would sort of copy their voices, it just made everybody smile. It made for a happy atmosphere. And it was just a bit of fun. Loved watching Mike Yarwood on a Saturday night. Yeah. And it was just a bit of fun. And as time went on, I was always one of those who didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew what I didn't want to do. And it just gradually, it just tunes in and click. There's just that moment when you know. I was probably on about 15 or 16 when I finally did think, well, I've got to follow this line, really. Mm. This seems to be the most plausible thing.
And I guess when you're younger and you're doing it, you're getting that validation and adulation from older people, more authoritative figures, that, you know, you're making them laugh, you're doing this thing. You're starting to get that warm feeling of making people happy, and that is quite addictive, isn't it? Especially at a young age.
Yes, I think so. It shows you're doing something right. It shows you're on the right track. It's sort of it acts like a signpost to say, right, this seems to work. Follow that. And there is a great collective joy about trying to make people laugh as much as you can. There is something very rewarding about that for all concerned, you know. So, yes, it's something that's very easy to follow. It's an instinct that you're drawn along.
Yeah, I have a confession at this point that I was often wheeled out at dinner parties because sort of 6 or 7 years old doing impersonations of – I only had like two I think I could do. One of them was – Jimmy Cricket, you remember the comedian?
Yes, yeah,
come here. And then the other one was John McEnroe, and I think it was only because I used to say you cannot be serious, but I think being an 8-year-old or 7-year-old child, it was hilarious, like hearing this kid doing this like outrage stuff. But yeah, but I always loved watching, like you said, like things like Mike Yarwood was always, and then you used to get, you know, you would get stand-up comedy shows on ITV and stuff where they'd always have an impersonator, and I always loved that section of it because it's just the idea of the linguistics around it and like learning voices and stuff I always found really fascinating.
Yes, just trying to get that sound in your subconscious whereby you know it sufficiently that you can recreate it somehow, and then knowing the bits, the aspects of it which are funny that you can exaggerate. Yeah. Like a caricaturist would. And those other funny little bits that people don't realise that they've noticed. And you get an element of surprise laughter. Oh, yes, they do that. They do. Mm. And it's this little cocktail of exaggeration and elements of surprise. And also reminding people about what's endearing about certain characters. Mm. All of those things mix into it. And make this cake, you know.
Yeah, I got two follow-up questions from that. Mm. First one is, what are those aspects? Like, is it like catchphrases? Is it facial tics or something? Or you know, what makes up that cake? And secondly, this is more of a deeper question. It's always done from a point of love, isn't it? It's always done from a point of admiration rather than a Mickey take, isn't it? But I guess that's quite a fine line to toe sometimes.
Yes, I think it is a fine line. Depends on the characters. Mostly there's great enjoyment in the... because you're fond of many of these characters. if it's a politician who deserves a bit of a slap and some criticism, then you enjoy administering that. Mm. You either enjoy the character or you enjoy throwing the custard pie and the rotten tomatoes. Yeah. And there's a feeling of worthiness that comes in that. Getting at the truth through ridicule is quite a powerful thing. It depends on the characters, really, which bits. One of my all-time favourite characters, I think, is because he's so distinctive and so full of all those wonderful traits and foibles and characteristics. Eubank,
Chris Eubank, because you know he speaks with a great sense of precision, which yeah. amplifies his sense of philosophy. You know, the boxer always beats the fighter. So, for those people who bet against the boxer, that was a bad bet because the boxer always beats the fighter.
I just love that sort of philosophy clicking over like that. And so boxing rivalries of the 1990s were always fascinating to me. I always loved that there would always be great juxtapositions between it. Answering at Eubank, you know, Nigel Benn would go, listen, you know, he's so, you know, this is just arrogance, this is nonsense, you know. And you will see, you know, you will see on Saturday, I've got to beat him, I've got it, you know, there's just no way. Also, Bruno and Tyson was a great one. You know, Tyson with that very high pitch, you know, he won't have to come looking for me, I won't have to go looking for him. Don't you wait, he can fight, he can either run and stay in the place out, he can come have fight.
No, I've got to be in there. Now he's a normal man. You know, he was shoes, he was socks. And I've got to go in there. I've got to take that title home, no?
Always lovely juxtapositions, the high pitch and the great depth.
The sense of philosophy and, you know, the one who loves the tear-up, you know.
Those rivalries are terrific.
So good. Tyson, so good.
I've always thought Tyson's voice doesn't match a box. His body. It doesn't, you know, it's the last voice you'd expect to come out of that body.
Yes, exactly. All the energy and the power was being channeled everywhere else.
Yeah,
voice. any sort of like bluster or power that was in the voice was channeled elsewhere. Yeah. Yes, intriguing characters. The 90s boxers was always a favourite area. I suppose because I was starting out at that time. You know, 1989, whatever. Those were the characters around at the time. So you always have an affinity for those that you first began looking at.
Yeah, and you did Hospital Radio, did you? That was quite an early part of your career doing that. And were you starting to experiment with some of these things then when you were presenting? And
oh, yes, it was very useful. Mm. It was very, very useful. A mate of mine, Pete Burgess, who I've not seen for years. I must see what he's up to. But he was a pal of mine and... Let's see, 1986, I think I just turned 18. And Radio Ormskirk General was a wonderful grey prefab plastic box just at the side of the hospital. And it was connected to the hospital with a line, a washing line, and the signal was transmitted across that to the main hospital. And they used to have pigeons and starlings resting on it. And in our imagination, whenever we did play level 42 and it was going through, it would make the pigeons dance a bit, you know. but yeah, throwing a few characters into the show was a handy little gimmick, handy little party trick to have Bob Geldof reading some of the requests out or whoever it might have been. You know, I hope I didn't startle the patients too much. Thank you for getting your request in. Let's have more of these. If we don't, that would be a disgrace.
And I guess also this hospital thinking they've got all these amazing celebrities to come and like do little voiceovers and stuff, like actually talk to the patients.
Yes, I think I would populate the show with a cast of several.
Yeah,
you know, like that. And it's always a great way of marking the era by the characters you impersonate. 1986, you know, Bob Geldof, Ronald Reagan. It really does define a period of time, the characters of that period that you go for.
Why? Because I'm just thinking about, like, imagine they had got those people in to do voiceovers. I think the reaction from the patients would be, oh, wow. But when they know it's someone doing an impression, they're like, that's a good one. Why is it that the impression is funnier than the actual person?
I think it's a little bit, because it's subversively mischievous.
Yeah,
in a benevolent way. And you're sort of all in it together, you doing it and the person listening to it. You're kind of in that together. And I think it's just a bit of benevolent cheek. There's the impudence. There's a sense of impudence about it that makes it so.
Yeah, shared cheek. Shared cheek is what makes the world go around.
Shared impudence. Yes, exactly.
Are there any that we've been chatting to you for 20 minutes now, and you have such a warm, fun character coming over, and I can tell you really enjoy doing these characteristics, and you really embody them, and you have fun. Are there any you don't like? Are there any you don't like doing, or has there ever been a point where you've got sort of bored of doing them, or frustrated, or are you just generally quite an upbeat sort of happy person that takes that into work?
Yes, I try to do that. I think we should do that wherever we can. You know, I think the only characters you get a bit tired of. I mean, David Cameron had a certain amount of blandness, just very anodyne, very waxy.
They were some of his better qualities as well.
Exactly. Yes, these were the things he was leading with. Yeah. Setting the stall out with those first. Yeah. Just a bit forgettable.
Really. Yeah.
You seem to pass through politics like a dose of salts. so one of those characters where you'd do it if you had to.
Yeah.
I've always been very admiring of Duncan Wisby, who did him latterly on Dead Ringers. And he found this extra little trait which made it really funny. You know, the generic posh accent was there and that kind of thing, the repeated hand gestures like this. Duncan gave him a little, an extra little slither, just heightening up the insincerity, heightening up that sense of entitlement, heightening up that sense of not having thought anything through and nipping off of the first available opportunity. Something like that. It was indiscernible, but he found it and really made it, sing, resonate. So Cameron was one that I enjoyed hearing Duncan do rather than doing yourself. It was nicer to play off than to do yourself.
Tell us about Spitting Image, because obviously that was, I used to watch it every Sunday night, 10 o'clock, I think it used to be on ITV. And it felt like at the time that all, like particularly the politics, so many different characters, very distinct characters. I don't feel like we have necessarily the same kind of thing now. Don't feel like we have the same kind of characters in politics. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But particularly in the 90s, there was very, very predominant characters. I mean, coming off the back of the 80s with obviously Thatcher and that Conservative government, and then, you know, and Labour as well. One question is, do you feel that that's the case, that we don't see those many characters in politics now? But also, yeah, how did you get into doing Spit Image? That was clearly a fun time. And working with some other incredible voice actors and stuff, you know, people like Steve Coogan working with Ian Hislop and stuff. So yeah, must have been quite an exciting time for a lot of you.
Oh, it was a watershed moment in my career, really, Spitting Image. It was my first job on TV or connected with TV. 1994 I joined, and I was 24 at the time, and really just, you know, starting out. I'd worked on radio for a while doing voices as a gimmick in the show. And there was a moment a few years before where I'd done an afternoon interview. I was working on Viking Radio, and I'd done an interview with Lenny Henry, who was doing a show at the Whole New Theatre at the time. And he was so much fun, and we had this lovely rapport, and he was hilarious, and that set me off. And we were just having lots and lots of fun with voices, sort of playing tennis with voices, really mucking about. And at the end of it, he said, you should send a tape to Spitting Image. They're always looking for people. And so I thought, oh, right, okay, that's interesting. So I said, thanks, Lenny, I will do. So I'd stay behind after the show and would just chop various voices together of that period of time, 89, 1990, 92. And so I'd do Chris Eubank, Terry Christian from The Word, John Major, Yeah, I think Terry Christian started it off, really. Yeah, welcome to The Word. We've got a load of guests for you today. John Major, Chris Eubank, Billy Connolly, all them. Right, eclectic.
Can you, yeah, so can you ever imagine that lot on The Word?
I want to go.
The Word was a good framing device.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I sent a few tapes in, and eventually there was a moment when Steve Coogan moved on from the show and it created a vacancy. So the producer, Giles Pilbrow at the time, said, okay, well, come in for the last episode and we'll give you a chance. We'll see how you go. And as luck would have it, they got me in for the first of the series rather than the last. And so, it was amazing to learn from everybody. Alistair McGowan was starting out at the time. I think he'd done one or two series by that time. John Thompson was in there being just utterly hilarious. Kate Robbins. And I really learned from them. They were kindly souls, and I sort of blended in, found my place, didn't create any ructions, and just mucked in, and did a few characters that they didn't have already. And so it just all settled, and it was very lucky to get in at the start of the series rather than at the end, because then, you know, they gave me a shot through the whole run of it, which was amazing, really. And then... That acted rather like a tractor beam, and gradually I moved to London, started doing more things on TV shows in the studios, BBC and LWT and so on, would contribute to other shows, more stuff on radio at Broadcasting House. And I got a London voiceover agent, all this sort of stuff, and eventually based in London in the sort of the later part of 1997, started working on The Big Breakfast, you know, just mucking about in the garden, helping out with certain features that they were doing, which was a great fun place to work back there at the old Ford Lock in the late 90s. That was how it all went. And Spitting Image was a big part of that. When you can say, oh, I've done a bit with Spitting Image.
Yeah, yeah.
But it gave you people just took a bit more notice than they otherwise might have done, you know. So, yeah, it's always about programs you work on, like a stepping stone for you to go to the and look to the next horizon. And then you reach there and onto the next horizon again. It's a build like that, you know.
Yeah, amazing how these little opportunities come up sometimes. And I guess it's just about having the mindset to be ready to take it and feel positive and be open-minded about what sort of comes next, I guess. Were you doing any live stuff at the time, on stage or anything like that?
Not really. I really did do it the other way around. I was a DJ on the radio, a presenter on local radio to start with. Occasionally you'd help out on a road show and play Rick Astley and, you know, Mel and Kim and give away T-shirts and mugs, that kind of thing. A bit like the Radio 1 road show, but in a car park in Chorley, at the opening of a washing machine shop, something like that. But I did used to do little 3-minute acts. At Viking Radio, one of the guys who wrote the adverts, a chap called Paul Sather, had a great dry wit, and he wrote the adverts. He was also pretty good with some gags. So he helped me write some gags for Billy Connolly and Patrick Moore and so on. And I did a routine just to see if I could do it at the Salt End Labour Club in Hull. And there was this chap who was said, right, what we'll do, okay, I'll introduce you. You take my mic off me, and then you do your 3 minutes. 3 minutes, okay, fine. Lovely Hull accent.
Yeah.
And there he was. And then when he went on the stage, you know, the Hull accent and all that persona just vanished. And instantly he sort of became Huey Green. We've got a great new act for you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. He's come all the way from Radio Viking. Give him a big round of applause and a great welcome, Mr. Don Coldstream. But it was such a funny world, you know, that those working clubs of that era. I was halfway through the act, and this chap bounced back onto the stage, yanks the microphone out of my hand, and I'm thinking, I was getting a few laughs. I didn't think it was going that badly. And he says, sorry to interrupt, Dan, just to let you know, at halftime, the onion sandwiches will be served on that trestle table rather than at the main kitchen door. Thank you so much, just to avoid confusion. Back to you, Dan. It's just the way it was done, you know, rough and ready and true.
That's incredible. Heckled by the lunch. That's
exactly. Yes, not many can say that. You know.
I've got a quick question just about accents, because I was just thinking that you're the aficionado in accents. What is the best accent in the UK?
Oh wow, the best accent in the UK.
Because I have an opinion on this, but I've
Maybe we should hear that first.
And you can tell me if I'm right. I'm probably wrong, but I think it's Geordie.
There is something up here. I mean, you know, there is something about it. There's something about the tune. I think there's something about the way it starts down there and ends up here.
Yeah.
You find that so many of the accents have the peaks and troughs. You know, Liverpool's got that great open sound like that. And so many of them have that kind of thing. Lancashire sort of goes like that. You know, it curls up like wrought iron fashion. You know, it sort of goes up like, I mean, it is it. But as Yorkshire goes to the way, Yorkshire, yeah, that's as maybe. You know, Lancashire's in a tizzy, Yorkshire's leaning on bar. There's two types of people. Right? Two types of people. Those who are from Yorkshire and them who wish they were. As they say. Yeah, Geordie is, there's a lot of music in the Geordie accent. There's a lot of, if you were to look at it on an oscilloscope, it would be dancing all over the place like that, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yes. I have a affection for that because my nan was from Durham, so but slightly softer kind of Geordie accent. But yeah, why APET and like just the some of the language, it just sings to me a little bit just because it reminds me
and some of the words, the Geordie accent will really gives the money's worth to words. Profiteroles.
Yeah.
Yes, gold. No syllable is wasted.
Absolutely. I mean, go on, John.
Yeah, I was just going to say the Welsh accent is another one where, you know, every syllable you get your money's worth, you know, every syllable is maintained and celebrated. No part of it is thrown away, which I rather love that too.
Yeah. I mean, they do, their town's names do have 400 more syllables than the rest of us anyway. Oh, so yeah. Loads to play with.
Exactly. Yes.
But I was going to say, are you a student of this, John? I mean, like, is this something that you, you know, obviously you've, over the course of many years, you've gained a whole caliber of voices and sounds and everything, but are you still kind of enthusiastic about learning and developing, like, sounds and voices and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yes, I think so. Yeah, you never stop that. There's always new characters and new people coming through, which will bring, they'll show different aspects of an accent you may already know well. Language evolves and so on. At the moment, there's social media and the shortcuts within that and the speaking in emojis and this sort of thing is having an effect on language. That's something you can play with and experiment with. So it's always shifting. If you look at a you know, a time-lapse picture of the atmosphere of the sun, and the photosphere is always swirling and moving like that, and there's always motion, there's always wet. And I think accents and the influences that make them evolve can be visualized in a similar way. It's always a living, breathing entity, the evolution of accents over time, which keeps it perpetually fascinating.
Mm.
That's a lovely way to explain it. Are you quite a visual person? Because I've noticed already you sort of talked about sort of, you know, the accents being looking like visual things. Are you quite sort of visual in the way you kind of do things and think?
Yes, I think so. It's quite a nice way to convey meaning and make things come alive. If you can describe things in that visual way. And all the way that I'll describe the Lancashire accent, you know, when you get to Rottenstall and Rossendale all around there, you know, Burnley, Blackburn, where it goes really like that. It's like a cheese sandwich that's been left in sun for a while and the crusts have curled up like that, you know, curled up. So, yes, it's a nice way to play with theatre of the mind. to apply visual comparisons to words. Yes. There's a bumblebee in here. I wonder if you can hear it. Is the buzz coming through?
We can't actually. No, it's okay.
It sort of reminds me, you know, Jamie Carragher, or you know, footballs like it's all like that. Thanks for your contribution. All right, I'll open the door in a minute. You can go and pollinate. All right.
There was a meme going around the internet of someone's like dishwasher door that made a sound, but it sounded like Stephen Gerrard in a press conference. And someone had just done like, so Stephen, what about to say? And then it went. Oh, poor guy. But it was very spot on.
Yeah, that certainly is. There's a wonderful fellow called Darren Farley who does a gorgeous Stephen Gerrard. Oh, it's terrific.
Yeah, he's very good. There's been, it feels like recently there's been an explosion of certainly on like social media platforms and short form of more impressionist. I mean, I follow a lot of football stuff, so certainly around football. But it seems to become a good medium for people to share those really quick topical impressions to react to stuff.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It just gives you that instant of opportunity to just have the idea, apply it to the voice, do it simply, and it's there. It's a great way of catching the topicality and just showing there's a great immediacy that comes with the social media, and particularly as a platform for impressions. I love Frank Caliendo, the American impressionist, who's so brilliant. I loved his George W. Bush, which was so cartoony, you know, the way that he would move around and... made it almost like a hybrid of Bugs Bunny at speed. It's so brilliant. He does this thing where every character just says the same word and the difference that comes from that, you know, the difference.
You know, you could have, if the word was biological, Tom Baker would say that a certain way. Brian Cox, biological.
It would bring out different shades of it. You know, Mick Jagger, biological. One could go on, but yeah, it's the immediacy of social media, TikTok, YouTube, and all of that. It's great for a quick hit, a quick fix.
Just digging into that a little bit, John. When you're in the process of creating your version of these people, how does that kind of, I guess, start? You know, I mean, firstly, do you specifically pick someone out and say, I'm going to do an impersonation of them? Or does it kind of naturally you start to feel yourself doing it? And then how does it work with regards to kind of practicing it and honing it and making it your own version of it, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Lots of listening. Usually we're starting a new series of Dead Ringers next week. So some of the early emails next week will be from Bill Dare saying, oh, has anybody got such a character, or anyone got a Steve Barclay? Anybody got? And so we're given these notifications. And then in previous years, when the show started, we'd be posted cassettes with voice clips on that the show coordinator had put together, or we'd be posted VHSs. And the clutter of tapes would be all over the place. Now, of course, you just dial them up on YouTube and just watch. And watching the same clips is a good thing. That gives you a good sense of familiarity. You get to know a character in that sort of way. So it's a good mixture to watch the same clip, but lots and lots of different ones at the same time. You need that blend of the familiar and the unexpected. And it's also important, once you've done a bit of the scrutinizing mode, to leave it, to step away. Don't overcrowd your head with it. Just let your subconscious sort a few things out when you're not actively looking into it. And then you come back a couple of days later and there's this nice pre-cooked familiarity that's already in there. And you can put another layer on the top. And you just build it up like that until your own subconscious starts to feel content with it. And it starts to think, yeah, I've got this now. And then as you perform it on the show and the more sketches you do, the more mileage with a voice, then it really settles in. A bit like a pair of boots. you know, you walk a bit gingerly at first, but then soon enough, you know, they're yours and it's your very own. And that's what's so interesting working with other impressionists, because we'll never notice the exact same things about people. You know, there might be some huge traits in certain characters that we all get, but each of us will notice our own different subtleties. And I think this is always a conversation that we revel in. I remember a few weeks ago doing some shows of Sorry I Haven't a Clue with Rory Bremner. And we were driving from one venue to the next, about a three-hour drive. And the joyful comparing of notes. And, you know, there's a kindred spirit with impersonators, I think. There is a kindredness, which is rather nice.
Yeah, that's really nice.
I was going to ask about that, actually, because you've like spoken really sort of fondly of a few others and people you like. And I know some areas of entertainment can be quite competitive, but is sort of the impressionist circle, I guess, quite supportive then of each other? Because I guess someone will do something some way, you'll do it a different way. And rather than being like, ah, oh, that's better than me, is it more like, oh, that's a nice way? And are people kind of, I guess, yeah, supportive and together?
Yes, I think so. You know, there might be moments when you're starting out and you're trying to get things established. You know, you might be a little bit more bullish then. But really, because it's all about characters and exaggeration and silliness, it never gets too far. It never goes. It always stays within a very benevolent sense of the Queensberry rules. You know, when Dead Ringers started out, we were conscious to be different to how Spitting Image had been. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to create a different tone to what Alistair McGowan and Ronnie were doing, which we could find, actually. You know, Alistair and Ronnie with The Big Impression, this was like a fabulous, you know, almost Hello magazine, turned into these beautifully observed and written sketches. The attitude of Dead Ringers was somewhere more between Private Eye and the Beano Annual, with topicality, going after a different crop of characters in a different way. We'd always try to be careful not to overlap too much. Certain things, you know, there might have been similarities, but we always had our own take on it. Mm. I think Alistair and I both did Parkinson, but we do it in entirely different ways. Mm. Alistair's Parkinson really parodied the chat show and all of its quirks. Our way of doing it was to, with hidden camera sketches, to go and sit at a bus stop and just interview your fellow passengers. Yeah. So long as you're bringing your own take to it, then that's good, and you can enjoy it and celebrate it together. And so long as it's a thing that you can, with jollity, compare your notes together afterwards, then that's good. And it's healthy. It's very healthy and nice to do it that way.
That's lovely. It's like art, isn't it? It's like two artists will sit and watch the sunrise, but they'll both paint it very differently.
Oh, that's a lovely description. I'm going to make a note of that. Good. In many ways, it's rather like an artist. Two artists painting a sunrise.
Oh, good. Oh,
you could have done a gym
analogy.
Yes, maybe Brian Sewell. It's very much like two artists seeing the same sunrise will interpret it in a very different way. Thank you for allowing me to steal that. I thought if I am going to steal it, I may as well do so immediately.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, with the comedy as well, like coming up with sketches, are you doing that in a room together? Are you kind of improvising stuff together? Are you working, or is it very, you know, you're sitting in a room scripting it? Like, how does that work?
What I tend to do is perhaps first come up with a broad idea. Wouldn't it be funny if Russell Crowe did Trumpton the movie? Or Jordan Peterson picking apart the logic of nursery rhymes?
Oh, my goodness.
Something like that. I think there would be, you know, if we think about Goldilocks and the three bears going into the house like that, there's a lot of bravery there, you know? You have to have that through life. You do. You have to have it. Otherwise, it's not going to work out. It's riffing there. Yeah, I would come up with a, you know, just a broad sensibility. And then the brilliant writers would go, oh, right, okay, I see, yeah, okay, I can see something there. Let me go and write that up. And then we'd read it through. Usually we get these finished scripts and we'll all read through them as a group. And, you know, there'll be some sketches which are the dashing leopards and tigers. Others are the limping antelopes. So the, you know, the sketches will come together like that. Some will need a bit of a trim and a cut down. But the writers themselves and Bill Dare, the producer, and Lawrence Howarth, the script editor, tend to see to most of that. And as we read it through, we might notice something or improvise something, and we'll add to it that way. So that's how it all fashions together, I think.
Yeah, collaborative effort. Yeah,
exactly.
I think that's where the best creativity comes from, I think. I'm just wondering, has there ever been anyone that you've just never been able to pin down, that you've just like, or anyone particularly you've had a real struggle to just really get the essence of, or maybe given up on, or still trying to?
I suppose it was David Cameron was always a bit like that. I remember, you know, Murray Walker, being asked to do Murray Walker, because he was so high pitched, it would sort of be quite painful to do that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how he kept going those commentaries for the entirety of a full race, but wow, so distinctive. But yes, you would use up the oxygen pretty quick.
Yes,
I suppose for the sense of, oh, what is it about you? David Cameron was always the most slippery like that, until Duncan decoded him.
Have you ever had anyone upset? Anyone? And I know, like, they're all sort of done with love. Politicians a bit more sort of punching up a little bit, but
we don't care what they think
properly. Well, even then, I think it's done sometimes. Well, I guess it depends on the politician, but I think there's always a sort of mutual respect, I guess. And like, it's done with, it's a pastiche, it's not a piss take. But has anyone ever got properly pissed off?
I think the only time that came along with that was Deborah and I were doing our impression show. And we did some sketches on This Morning, I was playing Eamon Holmes, you know, who has that great, that sort of tune to his voice. It's 8:15. These are the stories you're waking up to. This is what's going on. So it is. That's what's going on. And they built the This Morning sketch, which was quite expensive to do. So in those terms, you need to have, you know, a good return of sketches. So if you're going to spend that amount of money on a set recreating This Morning, we better have 5 sketches. To make it viable, this is the way the line producer would talk, and with these, Eamon's patience lasted for only for the first 3. it was sketches of him mistaking things for food. Where's the sofa? Where's the sofa gone? Oh, you mean that cake? Oh no, great, that was wee bit dry, so it was. Or where's our guest Frankie Dettori? Oh, you mean that wee gingerbread man? You just had that now. And I thought it was very surreal and very silly. And it was, you know, it was. And at first, Eamon found it quite funny, but I think 3 sketches in, it was, oh, come on, enough already. Enough already. So there was a moment there, but soon afterwards, you know, we were laughing about it. I sort of bumped into her and said, oh, God, sorry, we didn't mean to make you feel like that. We're sorry about that. That was never our intention to make you feel that way. And we had a laugh about it. It became jocular. So, you know, there was a time where we heard that Michael McIntyre was feeling a bit hard done by some of the sketches that we'd done, which I never believed was true. And it wasn't. I bumped into him at a variety club, a charity show. And he said, so I believe you've been doing me. So why don't you do me with me on the stage, and we'll auction it and we'll raise some money for the charity. He was straight in off the bat with that, which I thought was immensely generous. And I think somebody paid about £2,000 for the charity for us to just muck about like that. So So he was clearly quite happy with it. So you've always got to be careful with little tales that filter back to you.
Yeah.
Because they're rarely true, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
John, do you ever forget your own voice? Do you ever lose your voice? I mean, I don't know if that happens with, like, maybe when you're in the midst of kind of creating characters and stuff. Do you ever sort of sometimes think, oh, is that how I sound?
I don't think I lose my voice or forget it. I do sometimes forget that I'm doing others. It's a real habit to pepper the conversation and colour it in with other characters. And there's many times where I don't realise that I'm doing that. But at a time of speaking without, you know, in just complete relaxation, without going into it too deeply, yes, this is just the accent that comes out. I've heard Phil Cornwell impersonate me like that. Like a very sort of, you know, polite woodland creature. Yes, you know, slightly hesitant, and a bit like that.
It's great that you'll have to recall your own voice from another impersonator.
Yes, exactly. It's like recording.
Yes, that's what I sound like.
Yes, exactly. Which, yes, those are the bits where if I was to be exaggerated and by a caricaturist, that's how it sort of comes out, really. Yes, you know, a bit sort of, yes.
What's it like being impersonated? What's it like being on the other end of it?
It's quite a joy. It does make you laugh. You do find it slightly, oh, gosh, yes, I do. The reactions that you see from everyone that you do, you feel yourself. And that's only right. So it should, you know, there shouldn't be a let off. It should be quite, you know, slightly shocking and sort of, oh gosh, you know, it should make you feel quite conscious. And it does, but in a nice way.
Yeah.
You have to grudgingly say, yeah, yes, Phil, you're right. You're right. You have it. Danny Posthill is another chap who does a version of me like that. And it is, you do feel that sense. They say it's the greatest form of flattery. You do feel that. You do feel that. Yeah.
I think that's quite a nice, I think that's quite a nice approach to life. You know, you don't take yourself too seriously. And everything, if you kind of approach life that everything towards you is done with love and appreciation, then that's a much nicer way to float through life than thinking, oh, why are they saying that about me? Oh, why are they doing that? You know, if you take it all like, oh, yeah, okay, fair enough, I think you end up having a sort of nicer in existence.
Exactly. Overthink and you'll make it stink is a phrase I rather like.
Right, we're stealing that for a T-shirt. That's
yeah,
going
yeah,
to
be. Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, you can't be too conscious of things. Or the moment that you start taking anything far too seriously, you know, you should have a good professional sense with what you're doing, but don't take things too seriously. Don't take yourself too seriously. Otherwise, you're going to just—it's going to be a prickly journey through life, isn't it? That way, you know, one should walk through daffodils, not thistles.
Another good T-shirt.
Write that down as well.
A lot of T-shirts today.
Yes, a fashion range has been born, hasn't it?
I was just thinking there, Jim. We could have saved ourselves a lot of time and money if we'd not money because we never pay our guests, but. If we just got John on every week to do like various different high caliber celebrities, that we could have had all sorts of wonderful people on. We could have had
people who have passed away. We could have had people on the ether.
Just one last question, John. I know you've sort of we've talked a little bit about the impressions you find hard and the people that are difficult to get in with. What are the ones that, or is there a particular one that you have, you got to immediately and is one that you still find a lot of joy in doing?
Oh, yeah, there's tons of those. Tons of those. Patrick Moore was the very first one that I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always an interest in science and the eccentric presenters of that subject. I think another Carl Sagan, for he makes the universe as inspiring as it should be, the pale blue dot. Every person, every tyrant, every young couple in love, every hopeful child, every doting parent live their existence
in a mode of dust suspended in a sunbeam.
Okay. Who else? Yes, Alan Bennett. He's very joyful. He sort of makes every word sound very pleasing, good for the soul.
Les Dawson as well, a very wonderful sense of words. Very lugubrious tone, very lugubrious way of delivering things. So many. Bruno, Eubank, all of those, yeah. There's quite a clutch.
It's really nice hearing you enjoy doing those voices. And I'm taken back to the story of that teacher that you impersonated, and they said, "Oh, I don't sound like that, do I?" Because everyone hates hearing their own voice. Like, and some of us that, you know, we worked in broadcasting, you get used to it. And
yeah.
But I think talking to you today, I've got a real appreciation for just voices in general, and the fact that everyone's got different voices. It is yours. It is who you are. Yes, you can take elocution lessons and stuff, but really you can't change it too much. It is you. And I think, and I'm sure you've seen so many characters who aren't famous down the years. They've got wonderful voices. And if you did now, it wouldn't, you know, no one would get it because it wouldn't reference it. But I think it's just nice to appreciate, and you clearly have this appreciation of the voice, people's different characters, and it's just part of us, and part of, you know, we should be embraced, really, rather than, I don't know, disliked.
Yes, exactly. Tom Baker's come to mind as well. That's one I should mention. Yes, very much so. I remember recording some Big Finish Doctor Who stories, and in Tunbridge Wells, and just seeing Tom sitting in his chair there, recounting all of these tales. And I think I once saw him sort of speaking Hamlet's soliloquy in this very relaxed way. I think he'd been recounting the time of acting with somebody, and how the soliloquy was sort of a warm-up. To be or not to be, that is the question, whether it is nobler than I to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or take arms against the sheer troubles and by opposing end them. He just rattled these things off like that.
Amazing.
With this immense character. The Doctor Who's, I like the Doctor Who's voices somehow.
I think our John Pertwee has a tremendous resonance. I had five very good years of Doctor Who. I was very sad when I cried a great deal when we finished. You know. But I'm very emotive like that. I would have I had a good 5 years. Even if it had been 5 minutes, I would have cried too.
That's brilliant.
It's nice to just recount these you know, these little speeches you've heard and remember that summed the person up somehow.
Yeah. I've gone into an Alan Bennett frame of mind now.
But yeah,
you're quite reflective.
Well, I was going to say, like, one last thing is that do you ever get bored of doing it? Like, do you ever, like, feel, because I can imagine there's probably an expectation when people talk to you, and you've been very gracious in doing lots of voices for us today, and it's been wonderful and very enjoyable to listen to you. But do you, you know, like how sometimes comedians feel like they have to be on sometimes, and people say, well, you're not very funny in real life because you're just normal people, aren't you? Like everybody else, and you can't be, you know, that's your job or whatever. Do you ever feel like you just want to be John and not, you know, not be all these other characters?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think my normal mode in that way is to sort of continue acting a bit silly, really.
Yeah.
You know, people say, oh, just be yourself. But that mucking about and bringing in people from everywhere and Mr. Lesnar, oh, and then Alan Bennett and, oh, yes, then the geography teacher, Mr. Humphreys.
Yeah.
That's quite a natural setting for me. I suppose I must be just very unfocused. But that, for me, that is a norm. And I'm usually at my most relaxed when it tumbles out like that. It must be very annoying at times. But yeah, that's a norm, I think. And even if I was having a very, you know, philosophic, deep conversation with somebody, there might even be moments in that where appropriate characters would pop out. Carl Sagan would probably appear there rather than a more bombastic comedic person, you know. I've always had a habit of sprinkling in characters that fit the mood into the subject, very subconsciously most of the time.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, does it feel like it's a way that you can express yourself in, you know, like sometimes we as people, we can't always express ourselves, you know, through ourselves, if that makes sense. And actually being able to do it through, you know, it might be for some people in their art, it's expressing themselves through writing, or it could be a song. But for you, yeah, it's doing it through these, through these other voices and characters.
Yes, sometimes somebody will just come to mind and, oh, yeah, that suits this moment. And it just sprinkles in quite subconsciously, creates a bit of a laugh, which I think laughter is a very bonding thing, isn't it? I remember reading about how, as humans, we are genetically programmed to laugh and to seize onto humour, because it's very bonding in a group. Even when we were cave dwellers and, you know, going back into prehistory, laughter and humour would bond together the group. It promotes teamwork. Mm. It encourages the working together and the forming of bonds. Laughter is a great glue for all situations, really. Even in very difficult, very trying times, if you can find the humour somewhere, it'll help you put one boot in front of the other, you know. It's very important to us. We must never lose it. And then that's a thing, that's a note of caution about this era, losing the ability to laugh at ourselves and using offence as just a traction and as a currency on social media to gain points and likes and clicks. And I think this is a strange sort of dry rot that's running through everything, and we've got to be rather careful with it. Take great caution, as Obi-Wan would say. Intriguing.
Beautifully put. And I think a really nice place to round off the episode. John, it's been an absolute joy having you on. Thank you so much. It's just been absolutely joyous. Really appreciate it.
Yeah,
this is the quickest hour and 6 minutes I've ever known. So thank you.
No, it has. It's been such a joy. Thank you so much, John. Really appreciate your time. And like being so gracious and giving us so many wonderful little moments of your talent, which is very, very impressive.
Yes, it was a lovely chat. I thought we were just hanging out, having a brew. It didn't feel like a podcast at all.
Good. That's what we're trying to achieve. So that's great.
John Coleshaw on the Blank Podcast. What a lovely, lovely bloke. What a talented guy. It all comes so naturally, those voices. And yeah, as I said before, really, really just a very joyous hour in his company. And you've, as listeners, be grateful you've not got any impressions from us.
Well, I tried to slip in a couple like near the beginning, because I used to get, as people heard at the beginning of the podcast, I used to get dragged out for like dinner parties and stuff. Like, oh, look, it's... our kid can do a few stupid impressions. And it was just like, you cannot be serious, man. Like, I think, and then Jimmy Cricket, who's like a really not brilliant stand-up comedian. He used to do this thing, like, he used to go, come here, I want to tell you a story. Come here. And that was like his catchphrase, I guess. But I've always been fascinated in voices and impersonators. It's always like, I think it's such an amazing skill. There's a brilliant video on YouTube, people should seek it out, of Peter Sellers on the set of Doctor Strangelove, which would have been late 60s, I think. And he's doing various regional accents. And Peter Sellers, if people didn't know, like, he was an amazing impersonator and voice artist. And there's a bit where he's doing literally boroughs of London, like different boroughs of London, and the various different, and it's unbelievable. And I think, like, probably John's got a similar kind of level of skill with regards to, he was doing some of the accents, but it, well worth seeking that out if you're interested in this kind of stuff. But yeah, I just think it's really fantastic what he does, and such an amazing skill. And I think we've all been at school taking the piss out of our teachers and our friends. And I think, like, now when I tell anecdotes or stuff, I've got like two or three voices I always put on for those kind of things. One of them's Pete. There's a guy called Pete who lives in Seaford, and he talks like this, and that's like one of my voices that I like. If I'm telling a story, it always ends up going into Pete, and like my wife Michelle's like, "Oh, you're doing Pete again." I'm like, "Oh, sorry," because you know, you do Pete, you know. So any sort, oh, we're doing the show, it's great. So I think we all do that a little bit to a certain extent.
Yeah, quite a niche one, Pete. It's quite a small audience.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, yeah. And even the audience I've got that isn't that keen on it.
Oh, man. It's been, yeah, it's been a very, very lovely, lovely episode. So thank you to John for coming on. Really appreciate it. And yeah, I loved it. I loved it. Mm. And that's it. Back next week, Charles, as ever.
Yeah.
Another episode. But well, until then, hopefully. I'll be dictating all my messages to you via my phone and email now.
Yeah.
But I hope you have a love. Hope the weather stays nice and sunny where you are and where I am. Hope you have a good week.
Likewise,
looking forward to coming back next week. Yeah, with another episode of the Black Podcast. But until then,
well, crucially, don't just remember, Jim, don't get cancelled.
Media Podcast.